What is it, Batman?
I don't know. Whatever it is, it's awfully funny.
3, 2, 1.
Another countdown. Oh, God. Clayton, is this the final countdown?
This is the final countdown, Europe.
Right.
Welcome to the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. This is episode 162, if you're keeping track at home. Big, exciting day.
You don't have to, though. You don't have to keep track here. It is exciting. You know, it's strange that we would allude, if not apropos, we would allude to a group like Europe, which is perhaps often recalled as a one-hit wonder from the 80s, as today on the program, in a new segment that could only be called Where Are They Now?
Where Are They Now?
Where Are They Now? We've told you for weeks that we were hunting the guys down, and we've got Johnny Hates Jazz frontman Clark Datchler is coming on the program in just a little bit to tell us not just about the past of Johnny Hates Jazz, since both Clayton and I were tremendous fans of their big hit from the late 80s, Shattered Dreams. I would say one of my top five 80s songs.
I agree. It's definitely in my top 10, top 20, somewhere in there. It's such a great song.
I put it right up there with Always Something There to Remind Me and Steppin' Out and Everybody Wants to Rule the World. But not only that, not only are we going to talk about the past of Johnny Hates Jazz, but Clark has gotten back together with Mike, although Calvin has abstained from this newest incarnation of Johnny Hates Jazz, and they've got a new album and tour forthcoming. We're going to talk to him about that, his solo work, and everything else a little bit later on The Grizz.
Indeed. And, you know, so if you're not familiar with Shattered Dreams, perhaps we should just play, 30 seconds of it now?
Let's play the exact amount that doesn't get us sued. Ready?
Well, hey, we got permission. Johnny Hates Jazz gave us permission to play this song, so we'll play
it. Right, yeah. They've been very gracious to us in sharing media and everything else. So, Brett, if you need a little refresher course, how you could forget this song, I don't know. It's an awesome song. Here we go.
Yeah, here's 30 seconds or so of Shattered Dreams. Take a listen. There you go, a little Shattered Dreams. Love that song. Love that song. Of course, we're going to be talking about Turn Back the Clock, also one of their biggest album, I think, safe
definitely
to say.
Definitely. And, you know, that's the one, of course, when Clark was out in front and they had, although Shattered Dreams is really the one that's only known here in the U.S. In Europe, it spawned a couple other singles, I Don't Want to Be a Hero and Turn Back the Clock and Heart of Gold. And then, you know, Clark departed the group after that debut effort. And there is another Johnny Hates Jazz album without him as the front man, which was a big commercial flop.
Right.
It'll be interesting to hear what Clark has to say about the past, present, and upcoming, the soon-to-be future of Johnny Hates Jazz here on The Grizz. A couple things. Now, this sprung to mind, and maybe it's just because it came up on my iPod shuffle mode a lot recently. I would say that as it regards, and I know this is a tough thing to wrap your brain around, so I'll put the premise out there and I'm going to babble a little bit while you think about it.
Okay.
If you want to try and pin down the greatest pop singles of all time, as I thought about it, Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears is up there. Maybe, I think, the greatest pop single to ever hit radio. Now, I'm also, not only am I a longtime fan of the band, but I also think this stands alone as, like, it's unassailable. The Monkees covered Neil Diamond's song, I'm a Believer, mm-hmm. back in 1966. And it was, I'm 99.9% sure, it was far and away their biggest selling single. It was one of their three number one hits, along with Last Train to Clarksville and Daydream Believer. I think I'm a Believer is one of the best pop singles in radio history. But I have a favoritism toward Everybody Wants to Rule the World. I was thinking about that as I was reflecting on my very favorite 80s songs. What do you think if you had to put something up on the board?
Yeah, you know, I was curious because I'm wondering what the definition is, right? I think that could probably, you know, how would you constitute, what would make up one of the greatest pop hits? Does it have to be earworm ready?
You know, I'm not sure what that means, but
you know, sort of that you can't get out of your head. Right. All right. You get an earworm, okay. And it's there, right? It's well written. It's fun. It's singable. It's earworm now, ready. I mean, what would you say?
How many operations have you had for earworm removal?
Many. Many, many.
I do not know that expression at all.
You know, because there are songs, of course, that get stuck in your head, and you have to say, well, it's not a very good song, but it's catchy, right? You know what I mean? So, I don't know. There are a few that stick out to me that I almost would disagree with your assessment on Everybody Wants to Rule the World. To me, that's a great song. I don't know that it's a... Well, maybe not. It's up there. But I have to say a song like Billie Jean, it, you know, has to be at the top of that list, right? Mm-hmm. Or one of the biggest pop hits of all time, Every Breath You Take by The Police.
Well, now, it's kind of interesting if you want to talk about the segregation of music in that, you know, while Billie Jean, of course, crossed over,
right?
You know, lots of different genres. Like, and there were a lot of '80s artists that did that. You know, there was that early '80s. There was that big crossover of country music into Top 40. You would hear Kenny Rogers on Top 40. You'd hear Dolly Parton songs like 9 to 5. And thanks to crossover, like that's how like Juice Newton ended up in the Top 40, or Eddie Rabbit with I Love a Rainy Night, things like that. And then. You know, you have sort of stuff which might fall into an R&B bag. Obviously, you know, some of Michael Jackson's stuff or the preceding stuff that was done with the Jacksons crossed over, right? They sometimes did more bubblegum poppy type stuff, and sometimes they did more R&B. Or I think about the Pointer Sisters that I'm a big fan of. A lot of their stuff crossed over onto multiple charts as well. But I don't know that I think of – I don't think of The Police as a pop band in the same way that I wouldn't put Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin – in a pop bag. I don't. I see that as like a rock song.
Well, but you know, the true definition of pop music is popular music, right? It's commercially recorded music that's extraordinarily popular. I don't know. That's my added word to it, extraordinarily. But it's certainly popular music, and you don't get bigger than Every Breath You Take, do you? I mean, maybe Billie Jean. I'm a Believer, of course, a huge hit, but you know, Every Breath You Take was at the top of the charts for weeks and weeks and weeks. Mm-hmm. So
you know, this, of course, if you don't know this about Clayton, I'll tell you. Clayton is a massive fan of The Police and Sting, and you would probably know the statistics better than I. I think I'm a Believer was number one for 13 weeks, and also, you know, that. Right in that period of time when they very quickly, you know, they released the Monkees album followed by More of the Monkees, which was really like forced into the world by their record label without the band's knowledge. There's a funny story about that, by the way, about they were on tour at the time and Davy Jones walked across the street from their hotel into a store and discovered that their new album was on sale and no one had told them. But in any event, I don't know, now, one of the things that distinguishes Every Breath You Take from something like I'm a Believer or virtually any other single was for how many years that was the most played song on terrestrial radio, right? It had that unique distinction. No song had been spun as many times as Every Breath You Take for something like 25 years.
Right. It was huge. And of course, then it was brought back. And if you count, of course, the writing credit, I think then P. Diddy did you know, the tribute to what
did the abortion version or whatever.
Right, the terrible version, the tribute to Notorious B.I.G., you know, after his death, I'll Be Missing You.
Right.
But that counts, actually, because it's the same music, and so the writing credit still goes to Sting, and therefore the song, because of that song, ended up coming back and reclaiming the record again as one of the, you know, as one of the longest number one hits in music history.
Right.
So it's sort of broken up by like 20 years difference, if you think about it, 25 years apart from 1983, of course, is Every Breath You Take. And then whenever P. Diddy's version of it was in, you know, in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, I forgot, and I know we talked about this probably 100 grizzes ago. For a while, though, I'm not talking about writing credits. I'm just talking about spins that the song had on terrestrial radio. A song overtook Every Breath You Take. Do you remember this?
Yeah, and I think it was a Michael Jackson song. I think it was at the end of 1983, and if I'm not mistaken, it was Paul McCartney, Michael Jackson's duet. Was it Ebony and Ivory?
Oh, no, Ebony and Ivory is Stevie Wonder.
Oh, that's right. But no, it was...
The Girl Is Mine is what you're thinking of.
Yeah, but, I'm pretty sure that's it.
But, no. I mean, I'm talking... This just happened in the last 5 years.
Oh, as like a monumental...
overtook the total number of plays of Every Breath You Take. And, it, you know, it was one of those... that you were, it wasn't necessarily something that you didn't see coming either. Like, I don't know if it was that Celine Dion song from Titanic or like one of those that was like overplayed to death, like Smooth featuring Rob Thomas by Santana. But for a while, anyway, and I don't know if this changed then with the way they chart things because of satellite radio, but some song overtook Every Breath You Take as the most played song in radio history. And I can't remember what that song is.
I do. I now that it's coming back to me. You've Lost That Loving Feeling.
Really? Interesting.
I'm pretty sure that it was You've Lost That Loving Feeling. I remember hearing that because I remember doing some news stories on it, and it sort of, you know, it came back into popularity as a result of like all a bunch of news shows playing that song and talking about it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I did not realize that. Hey, if you are new to the program here, a couple things. One, we here at Grizzly Productions produce an incredible number of podcasts. In fact, Clayton and I team up closer to the end of the week for a video show called Daddy On Board. Clayton hosts the ever-popular The Trending Show with his wife, Natalie, who's also over on Mommy Beta. If you're a sports fan, you're going to want to check out Paul Roberts on the twice weekly sports report. And we have just rolled out a brand new podcast for people like Clayton and I, especially, who are a little bit behind on what's going on in the world of comic books. Joined Todd and Leonard over on the weekly Long Box. We're just kind of getting the kinks out right now. A beta episode, episode zero, is available over at grizzlyproductions.tv. And you can follow everything that we do at grizzlyproduced on Twitter.
Indeed. We're really excited about our new show, The Weekly Long Box. Bear in mind, it is in beta. We're still working out some audio issues, getting that up to snuff for you. But it's in beta, so episode zero was published with Todd and Leonard this past week. And it's great because a lot of people on Twitter have been saying, hey, I've been behind on the new 52 from DC. Some saying, hey, I really don't enjoy the new 52. Others saying we really like it. Can't wait to hear how Todd and Leonard discuss that and digest all the new books. I mean, these two guys, as you've heard from the past episodes that they've appeared here on The Grizz, these guys, you know, spend a lot of time in the comic shop. They read just about every book that comes out. They read indie books. They read Marvel, DC. These guys are up on everything. So we defer to them for their deep knowledge, and we'll be enjoying that show immensely as it takes off. So, oh, and by the way, I should mention, we start a little contest for the Weekly Long Box. They are Weekly Long Box on Twitter, just Weekly Long Box. No article on the front of that, no the. And we're giving away a Sonos to one person out of the first 1,000 to follow them on Twitter. I think we're already up to 200 followers or so on Twitter.
And
so,
this Sonos sound system, kids, if you're wondering what we're talking about here, it works wirelessly throughout your house. The Sonos Bridge with the Sonos Play 3 and Play 5. If you were to go out right now, for example, I just saw they rolled out massive displays at Targets in my area, you would spend almost $750 on this state-of-the-art sound system, and we are giving it away for free. So make sure you go and follow Weekly Long Box on Twitter to be in the running for this exceptional gift.
Exactly. So I should mention, okay, so Every Breath You Take, you had asked the question, I never answered you, was, you know, sat at number one for 8 weeks in 1983. That certainly did not hit the 13, but I did know, of course, that it, you know, came out through the summer and did pretty darn well, you know. And then it was 1997, I couldn't quite remember, when Puff Daddy did the I'll Be Missing You version of the song.
Right.
It also won for Song of the Year that year for a Grammy Award.
I was going to say. And let's never discuss the Puff Daddy version again. So I'm betting today, of course, some new listeners are coming on board, perhaps. They're interested to hear what Clark from Johnny Hates Jazz has to say. But I'm also aware that very recently a lot of new people have joined us here on the program, including some old friends of mine, you know, acquaintances of mine from over the years, who really, they kind of keep up with what I'm doing through this podcast. And if you don't know, apart from being a podcaster here with my longtime pal, Clayton Morris, I'm also a professional wrestler. And Clayton, of course, apart from podcasting with me, is also a professional television broadcast journalist, a la Bobby the Brain Heenan. And so...
if only I could be that hot.
Somewhere in the background, someone's chanting weasel. I think a lot of our friends, you know, or acquaintances over the years, because it can be difficult to keep up with us. Like, as I've said numerous times on The Grizz, like, I'm not a good phone person. I hate being on the phone. And we're just, like, mired in emails all the time. Like, we're not good at keeping up with people other than you and I have to get together every week to do this podcast. So, like, you know, we're in more intimate touch than we are with a lot of our other friends. But
right.
a few of them, including my longtime friend Drew Lazario, had recently asked me. He said, you know, I've been listening to your podcast. He listens to it while he works. And he says, but why the heck is it called the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe? And it called to mind the fact that, you know, although we've explained it maybe two or three times in the past, here we are 162 episodes in.
Right.
I don't know that we've explained the backstory on this very recently.
No, we haven't explained it recently. People always find it such a unique name, but they always ask that question, where in the world did that come from? Right. And of course, this was the first show that we started here on the network, and now we've grown to, what, 8 different shows now
right.
on the network, which is crazy. So, yeah, this came out of something from our childhood. I mean, you want to help explain this bizarre name?
Sure. Well, you know, Clayton and I have been best buds now for something like 25 years. We grew up across the street from one another in an idyllic PA suburb called West Lawn, which actually no longer exists. It has been, like, rezoned, and it's part of Spring Township. So right. our hometown doesn't even exist anymore. In any event, one day, because as lovers of the comic book medium, we would sometimes make these little comic booky doodles and slip them into each other's Trapper Keeper, which is a very dated 80s reference. One day, my friend Clayton left this sketch for me of a character he made up called Zip the Ghost Egg. And Zip the Ghost Egg was just that. He was just an egg with a sheet over him with two eye holes cut out, as this egg was somewhat humanoid, I guess.
But very, I mean, excellently drawn, by the way.
Oh, my God, yeah.
yeah.
In fact, at a comic book convention, I once showed it to Alex Ross, and he wept. So, to further define, distinguish, or characterize Zip the Ghost Egg, who by himself, admittedly, didn't seem to have a lot of juice in him, my friend Clayton wrote in parentheses, to frighten grizzly bear eggs. And even now, I'm not entirely certain. I what I'm imagining is that his arch nemesis was the grizzly bear egg.
Right.
But he was not. He was off panel somewhere. He was right. not illustrated.
He was conceptualized, but never came to form. I mean, something I've been working on, just never managed to make it.
Right. So that's a chunk of the story. And then when this show began now, it was formulated, what, about 3.5 years ago is really when we had the discussion about this, I
right.
guess.
Right.
We were at the King of Prussia Mall outside of Philadelphia in the outskirts of Philly. And we were at a Gloria Jean's cafe that happened to be there, no longer exists either, much like our hometown. And we were talking about creating a podcast and what we wanted it to feel like.
Right, right. I mean, and you and I love the cafe experience, sitting in a cafe, having a coffee. And we said, you know, we want to have this show sort of have this cafe feeling. We're two friends. You and I would talk every week on the phone for an hour, no matter where we lived across the country. And we said, you know what, we need to just record this. I'm sure there are plenty of geeks out there who enjoy the same sorts of stuff that we do. Mm-hmm. Probably may find some enjoyment. And we are right. We've been right because we have hundreds of thousands of listeners now. So, but, you know, we had this sort of cafe feeling to it, right? There was a cappuccino machine in the background. We got some coffee going. And you and I were just talking about, I don't know, we were talking about Batman or something.
Mm-hmm. We do. We often talk about Batman. He comes up a whole lot more than you would think, among other things. And so you can tell it's from these disparate elements here is how the name of the podcast came together. It is as esoteric, perhaps, as the contents of this program. And we've tried over the years, you know, probably Clayton more so than I is, you know, this whole thing is really Clayton's brainchild, as is Grizzly Productions and everything else. And in that way, I'm trying to think what would be, like, the best way that I could characterize it. Clayton is a lot like Space Ghost to Grizzly Productions, and I'm Blip the Monkey. Like, I have a little bandit mask that I wear, and in most of the episodes, you're just thinking, I think he's just there to be like Gleek. So Clayton's kind of the Space Ghost here. He's always out there, right? Like, you're constantly dealing with all of these great companies that come in to sponsor us. You're dealing with the media and everything else. I'm in the back of Space Ghost's ship eating a banana. And Clayton has to try and describe to people what this show is. And I think originally, like, the first way we kind of put it out there was we just called it an omnibus podcast about pop culture. But it's really changed. If for some strange reason you went back and started listening to The Grizz from episode 1, and I don't even know if that's still out there somewhere, if you can get it in iTunes or what. But the first 10 to 20 episodes of this podcast, it was a very different creature because we really wrestled with the concept, I think, of what's our authentic voice.
Right.
What is it that we're trying to say to the audience? And eventually, all that just kind of fell away, and it really just became you and me talking.
Like, right, which...
We got away from what the original thing was, and then eventually we just came back to it. And when we came back to it, that's really when this thing became very popular. And as you've probably heard us mention, although not enough recently, about 2 million people listen to this program every week. And if you're one of them, we need your help. Go to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. We got to get back on the top of the search results, okay?
Yeah, we haven't done that in a little while. So thanks to all of you who have left us a nice 5-star result. Yeah, I think that's interesting you bring that up. You know, we kind of got away from it. We were trying to put some sort of a format into the show. We were trying to do some different things.
It was a little more like news magazine style. And I don't know why we just kind of fell into that.
We had Stone Phillips on the show for a little while.
Remember
John Stossel had a segment, and we just, you know,
you're going to think this is a joke. This is not a joke. Clayton once ran a book club with Karl Rove.
Right.
That sounds like the kind of thing I say insincerely on this program. That's a real thing.
Right. So yeah, then we just got back to, you know, whatever happens during the week. So yeah, let's say you and I are currently watching Breaking Bad, and I think next week on the show, next episode, we're going to talk about season 2 of Breaking Bad,
or maybe the week after.
Yeah,
just throwing that out there.
We don't know. Mike's way behind. You can tell. You can infer.
I'm only on episode 2 of 13, so I am a little behind.
But sort of whatever, you know, has been going on lately. There's a couple of movies coming out that I know that you and I want to see during the holidays, there are, you know. So I'm sure we'll have a bunch of movie talk. There's been a dearth of decent movies lately, though. Wouldn't you say?
Right, and I think, you know, apart from the fact that we talk music, as you've already gathered, and we're going to be talking TV some more and movies upcoming. Next year is going to be big, big, big for superhero movies, and that, as my friend Clayton likes to say, is right in our wheelhouse.
Indeed. Yeah, so we talk about that on the show. You know, we'll both go see some different superhero films, what we're reading, what we're chatting about, what we're drinking, and we complain a lot about society, so that's what you get on this show.
That's right. On the flip side here, we're going to take a break here just for a second and tell you a little bit about a great show sponsor of ours. I want to talk about what today evokes historically for you and I. But before we get to that, we should really take a moment and thank a fantastic show sponsor of ours. They are the great folks at Gazelle.com, who have been with us here at Grizzly Productions for quite some time.
Yeah.
We're glad that they like us because we like them. And here's what they're going to do for you. You're going to round up a big pile of used consumer electronics like old cell phones, MP3 devices, monitors, you name it, camera lenses. In all, there's over 250,000 different consumer goods like this that Gazelle.com will purchase from you. You go right on their website, tell them what you've got, you tell them what condition it's in, and they're going to make you an offer that's good for the next 30 days. And when you accept it, they'll send you a prepaid shipping label. Sometimes they send you the box, too. And it gets whisked away to their secret headquarters off on a mountaintop somewhere, where they're going to evaluate this item. And if it matches your description, they're going to give you the money that they'd agreed upon. They'll give you a paper check, send it to your PayPal, give you money to use on Amazon.com. You can even donate it to charity if the holidays brings that out in you. It's very, very simple. Every time I've ever used them, I've been paid within 7 days of them getting my goods. We like them because it's a streamlined process that's so simple, even a broadcast journalist and professional wrestler could figure out how to do it. We also like them because we found them to be incredibly honest. On those occasions when our goods are actually worth more money than what they'd originally quoted us, they give us the difference. And I like that a whole heck of a lot. And they're eco-friendly.
Indeed.
So, if your goods are absolutely obsolete or otherwise worthless, fear not. After wiping your personal info off the gadget, they'll recycle it in a responsible way. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Won't you go over and see our friends at Gazelle.com? Let them make you a couple extra bucks just in time for the holidays. And should they ask you upon checking out of their simple-to-use system, hey, how'd you hear about Gazelle.com? In that drop-down window, please indicate that it was through the Clayton Morris podcasting empire, asterisk, thanks Blip the Monkey. That's how they know you heard about them from us.
Yes, that is right. We thank Gazelle so much for their support of this show.
So, this time of year recalls a couple things for me. First and foremost, November 20th is an interesting date for both Clayton and I, as on that date, 18 years ago, our band, Edgar Oliver Rice and the Pistachios, played our first full-on and last concert. And it was a somewhat dismal affair. to say the least. Clayton, I think, toward the end of it, was contemplating suicide.
Right. It was pretty close. I mean, if you watch that videotape, and now you and I really had no musical talent at the time. I mean, I could strum a few chords on a guitar.
Right. That's why you were the drummer.
Right. Exactly. You could play a washboard.
I did with a metal thimble.
But our goal was, of course, to sort of emulate in some ways our favorite band, They Might Be Giants. Of course, we had They Might Be Giants here on the show a few episodes ago. That was very exciting. Big, huge fans of them, of course. And, you know, you and I think tried to emulate at least their style, their sarcasm, their poignant lyrics. And we wrote a whole series of songs. Of course, we put out a few albums that were only purchased by like 30 people in our high school.
Yep.
We've actually played some of those terrible songs on the show maybe like 60, 70 episodes ago.
Right. I don't know why we did that.
I had to get them out there because the fans were asking for them. So someday
they were not. We'll debate that into senior citizendom. No, they were not.
They were begging for Edgar Oliver Rice and the Pistachio Music, and I couldn't keep it from them.
Right. Right. It was your social obligation. It's like jury duty.
Right. My civic duty.
So, thank you. Yeah. False. So, and you know, to that point, of course, we did. We actually played a They Might Be Giants song at that concert. We played Anna Ang to the best of our ability. So, you know, this time of year always kind of recalls that, you know, November 20th, that date kind of looms large. November 20th, 1993, we did, for better or most likely for worse. We played our only full concert, did the Pistachios on that day. But also, it is right around this time, and this now occurred 11 years ago, when my pal Clayton, then stationed in Helena, Montana, the capital of Big Sky Country, Helena, Montana, I came out to visit you for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was working on a memoir of mine called Headquarters, and this was really like, if you want to talk about it in terms of like the market number, this was you at the bottom of your TV career starting to work your way up, right? I don't know that there are markets a whole lot smaller than Helena, Montana to get your broadcasting sea legs.
No, and I, you know, it's funny, last night I was talking to a buddy of mine. We went and watched the Eagles-Giants game together, and we were. He said he knew a friend who had started in local television also and worked in West Virginia. And I said, West Virginia? I did as well. I never knew the gentleman, but yeah, he worked there. And he said he was given an opportunity at one point to work in medical sales or medical device sales, this individual. And he sort of, you know, did this pro and con list in his head, right? And to work in local television, you have to give up a lot, right? You have to move somewhere exotic or dull and probably really far away from your home unless you have some sort of family member who works at a television station that could get you a job, right? And he was confronted with the idea of either making $7 an hour in a local television market as a reporter, which, you know, is like poverty line, right? Or make an incredible amount of money doing medical sales. So he gave up his dream of television, and that's what he's been doing for his life. I didn't. I continued on, and I was making about them. I wasn't making enough to even cover my rent when I lived in Montana. That old Victorian house that you'll recall. And it was funny because I didn't want to turn on the heat in that house because
I do recall that.
I mean, it was so expensive, right? It's this old Victorian house that's in Montana. It's poorly insulated. I'm making no money. So to put on the heat so that it's at a, you know, 68 or 69 degrees, I'd be paying like hundreds of dollars a month in heat to heat that whole thing. So what I would do is I'd get like a little area heater and just put it in the room I was going to be in. And would flip it on. Unfortunate for you, when you came to visit, I only had one of those area heaters. So if you were in another room, that I was going to be in the heated room. That's why I just would send my cats in to visit you.
That's right. Yeah, I would pile the cats on top of me to stay warm. But it was, I'm grateful for that trip. You know, I really kind of fell in love with that area while we were out there, and even then subsequently forced my wife to visit Montana with me because it really kind of seeps in, you know. And maybe that speaks a little bit to our experience as East Coasters in that it really seems as if what goes on there is wholly removed. It's like visiting another planet to go there, and there's a charm to that that's sort of irrefutable. I always kind of reflect on that week we spent in Helena, Montana over Thanksgiving, which is now 11 years ago. hard though that might be to believe. Incidentally, quick for you if you're new to the Grizz here, that episode Clayton alluded to earlier, John Flansburgh of They Might Be Giants, can be found on episode 150 of The Grizz, which was a landmark. We've had some good guests on the landmark episodes. Back at 100, I think, is when we had Stan Bush on. 150, we had John Flansburgh. So
We had Mike Nelson from Mystery Science Theater on. And what's great about doing this show is that we just get to have on the guests that we want to have on. It's our show, you know.
Right.
It just turns out that a lot of these people are well liked by many hundreds of thousands of other people. So that just works out for us nicely.
And you know what a thrill it is for us in that, like, I send Space Ghost out into the world with his media Rolodex to track down all the people we want to talk to, and lo and behold, most of the time they end up showing up.
Indeed, like our next guest, might as well waste no more time in featuring our "Where Are They Now" segment that we've been talking about, and bringing in none other than Clark Datchler from Johnny Hates Jazz. Mike, do you want to do a nice little intro for him?
Well, loyal members of the Egghead Army and fans of Grizzly Productions, you have heard us talk about this for weeks now, and we are really pleased to have with us on the line none other than Clark Datchler from Johnny Hates Jazz, as promised. Clark, how are you?
I'm doing good, Mike. How are you doing?
Very, very well. Thanks for coming on to talk with us about not only the past of Johnny Hates Jazz and your solo work, but what's upcoming as well, as we were really excited to learn that you and Mike are working together again on something new.
Yeah, we're working on a 10-track album, which we're about, I'd say, 60 to 70% through now. Mm-hmm. It's been a great experience working together again after all this time with Mike. And of course, there was originally three of us. There was myself, Mike, and Calvin,
right,
and Hayes. But there's Calvin's off doing his own thing now, other things. And Mike and I go a long ways back. I mean, we started recording together, just he and I, some years before Johnny Hates Jazz was formed. So it's kind of cool coming full circle and finding ourselves working on this album, you know, in 2011 with all that history behind us. It's cool.
And it begs the question, you know, why did you guys decide to get back together? I think Mike and I, we had been talking about Johnny Hates Jazz on a couple of past Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe episodes, and we jumped on your website, and lo and behold, a beautifully designed state-of-the-art website, and Shattered Dream starts playing right there, and we found out that the new album was in the works. Why get the band back together?
There's many reasons for that. I mean, when I was first approached to rejoin Johnny Hates Jazz, having really focused for some years on my own solo work, I was still living in the States at that time, and I wanted to focus on doing a new album. And at that point, that was not the focus that collectively everyone agreed on. But we decided to do a few gigs together, which we did, and they went well. And I was already writing songs for a potential new album. Whether that was going to be a Clark Datchler album or a Johnny Hates Jazz album was in the balance. And I started to play the songs to Mike, and it became pretty clear that, you know, we should be doing this together. And I think also there's something about the time feeling right, because if you recall, Johnny Hates Jazz were in the public eye for a fairly brief time. I mean, it was a very bright time. We made quite an impact in many places around the world, but it was fairly brief because I left. Mm-hmm. And I think we had this feeling that we had yet to do. We just didn't know when we were going to come back together and keep going. We didn't really think it was going to be this many years later, but but here we are, and it feels right to be doing that.
One of the things that we had noticed that was very interesting to us is that hopefully, upcoming perhaps to coincide with your new work, is that you guys will be out touring once again. And one of the things, and I discussed it on a previous Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, is a lot of times here in the U.S., and I realize these tours are in the U.K. as well, you see groups packaged together in these, I don't even know how to describe them to you, like a package tour, where perhaps they're taking advantage of the fact that some acts. And for example, you know, as you said, during that brief period of time that Johnny Hates Jazz really was out in the forefront with the success of Shattered Dreams, as well as Heart of Gold and Turn Back the Clock and I Don't Want to Be a Hero, it seems like those couple of songs are perhaps what you're best remembered for. And it's going to be really exciting to see you back out there with new material as well. Do you expect that, you know, at least as it had mentioned on the website, that you're going to be able to really get out there and see the world again? Do you anticipate that it'll draw the attention of the world once again, like you guys did enjoy back in the late 80s?
I think that it's a really good question, Mike. You know, I'm not a great fan of these package tours, which, and the reason I'm not is that they're all well and good, and I'm sure very enjoyable for people who remember the era of the 80s for the music and what their own experiences were during that time. So to go to those shows is, you know, it has its appeal. But for me personally, I embrace very much what we did. You know, those are my songs. I'm very proud of them, and I want to focus on what we have yet to give, because for me that is equally as important. So in that respect, all we can do is do what we think we do best. From my part of the collaboration between myself and Mike, I'm predominantly a singer and songwriter. So I'll write the best songs that I can for this project, as I did for the Turn Back the Clock album. Mike is an exceptional engineer and producer, and he's bringing his great skill to bear, as he did back then. So we're going out with a strong hand. It's a different time now. We're very aware of that. But I think that anyone who's going to be hearing the new material is going to recognize immediately that it's Johnny Hates Jazz, and they're going to hear that it's Johnny Hates Jazz in 2011, 2012. It is a modern version of JHJ. So, you know, as far as how we're going to be received, we have very high hopes. We'll see what happens.
When you look at the era of 80s music, I was reflecting on this not too long ago with my wife as we were talking about, you know, the aughts, right, the early 2000s and into the 2000s and 2010 through 2020, that period in music, which doesn't seem to have a clear definition. If you were to say to someone, how would you describe the music of the first 10 years of 2000, what would that sound like? It sounds like it doesn't have an identifiable sound. The 90s certainly do. The 80s certainly do. The 70s certainly do. And when you look at the music of that generation of the 80s and you compare it to what you're seeing now, do you see any parallels, or do you say to yourself, boy, I wish it was the 80s again?
I don't wish that it was the 80s again, in the sense that I'm a great believer in living in the present and appreciating what the present has to offer. I think that one thing that I feel is that it must be very hard for musicians, young musicians in the 2000s, because so much has now been done in the history of recorded music. So it's very hard to be 100% original anymore. It's really hard, and I don't judge anyone for that. I think that actually my son put it pretty well. He said that in his opinion, now he's 19 years old, so, you know, he's of obviously a much younger generation, and his feeling is that what we're hearing now are different amalgamations of what has already been but put together in a new way. And I think that in some ways that is what is happening, and that is the identity that exists now. But certainly in terms of an identity of sound and also visuals of the 80s, I think that I don't know if we're going to see that again, to be honest. It was a very, very clearly identifiable era.
Well, you know, Eggheads Clark may have characterized himself as a singer-songwriter, which is certainly true, but he's also a very gifted multi-instrumentalist, among many other things that he does. And I think a lot of this, all of your various skills and talents, I think, are really showcased on a work of yours called Tomorrow. And I'm hoping that maybe you can tell us a little bit about this solo work of yours and what led to Interaction Music, maybe about its release as Night Fox. Can you take us through a little bit of that part of and helping us fill in the blanks, right? After Clark departed Johnny Hates Jazz, you went to work. Yeah, you were very, very busy in those intervening years. Can you tell us a little bit about that, specifically Tomorrow?
Sure. Well, just a very quick bit of background to what I did after I left Johnny Hates Jazz. It was a very challenging time in the 1990s for any musician who had arisen in the 80s and really had a lot of focus in that time. It was an era which I felt wanted to almost sever itself from the lineage of what had been before. I'm not talking about just the 80s. I'm not talking about the 70s and 60s as well. That's certainly how I felt. I mean, the music business was changing. The media world in general was changing, and we were seeing small independent companies being bought up and swallowed up by multinational corporations, and that changed the face of things and how music was approached in the 90s and then onto the 2000s. So I did a lot of work at Real World Studios in the west of Britain, which is Peter Gabriel's studios. I live close by, and I went through a couple of important changes in my life. One is that I became a father, and I think through that I woke up to the world that my kids are now embracing and growing up in, and the biggest thing that was of concern to me and still is what we're doing to our planet. Mm-hmm. And especially imagining what that's going to be like for the younger generation of today, and then the younger generation of tomorrow, and what they're going to be facing on a planet with such a potentially uncertain future, whether that is a result of climate change, or whether it's a result of overpopulation or scarcity of resource, or simply treating our home planet with such disregard, as I think we do as a people. I really wanted to express that musically. So as I was doing that at Real World Studios, I was also getting exposed to a lot of world music. And when it came down to starting work on the album Tomorrow, I really wanted to fuse together some world instrumentation with my passion for the earth, and also the fact that I am still quite a classical songwriter. So, you know, I knew I wasn't going to make a world music album. It was going to be a song based album, but I really wanted it to be an album with something to say. So, although not every single song is about the earth, and I didn't want it to be that way, certainly the core sense of the album is one of concern for our future, hence the title Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So Tomorrow took a long, long time to write and record. In all honesty, I'd say the journey probably lasted close to 10 years. And one of the reasons for that was that I decided with my co-producer and co-writer on that project, a woman called Shiana Breiter, that we were going to go to fairly remote places in different parts of the world to record, to just see what influence that had on the music we were going to be recording. And so we set up studio in some fairly remote places in the UK and the US, and also mainland Europe, and the result was, I think, was profound for me in terms of creating that album, and hopefully in years to come, Tomorrow will be heard by more and more people.
Yeah, it was remarkable to read some of the comment threads over the past few weeks of just individuals who are discovering your solo work for the first time and were blown away by it and weren't aware of what you were doing and had come to discover it, either whether it was through MySpace or Facebook page or other places. Nice to read. And I think there's this perception, and you can squash it if you like, that, you know, you have a big hit like Shattered Dreams, and that the royalty checks just roll in for the rest of your life, right? And that you can live off that huge, huge hit internationally. The album was huge. Other songs are huge. And that, you know what? This guy doesn't need to work anymore. Pull back the curtain a little bit on what it's like to be a success and be at the height of your game at that point, and what you do now. I mean, is that the case? Are you able just to ride high and you wouldn't have to work anymore?
That's a very interesting question, Clayton. I think Shattered Dreams, you know, gets played a heck of a lot. I mean, it entered the 3 million category of U.S. airplays alone a short while ago. So it's been played worldwide a lot.
Wow.
However, it really does depend on what you think of quality of life being. I am not someone who ever wants to live a safe life or just a secure life. It's not that I don't. We all crave a little bit of security, of course.
Right.
But I think that one of the powers of music, and even though it's a very different time now and the music business has changed practically beyond recognition, it is still the art form that is able to connect with people on such a deeply emotional level that I think it still has a great part to play in how we imagine and therefore shape our future. And in some ways, I guess this touches a little bit on what we were talking about regarding the difference between now and the 80s. What I would like to see and what I've tried to instill in this new Johnny Hates Jazz album is making sure that there is still music out there that wants to talk about things and subjects that are relevant to our times. So it's not all about dancing, and it's not all about partying, and it's not all about love even, which is a fine and noble thing to write about. But music needs to become relevant again to humanity as a whole, to us socially as well as emotionally, globally as well as personally. And that is what motivates me to keep going and keep doing what I'm doing, because whether the financial reward is high or low or somewhere in between, it's in another way, it's not the reward at all. The reward is really feeling like you're communicating with people. That's the biggest reward, to know that somehow people are hearing you and being touched by what you're saying and what you're singing about, what you're writing about, and somehow, you know, it reflects things that are important in their lives. That's the reward.
Hmm. Well, something you said there got me thinking, Clark. Obviously, and both Clayton and I, as well as a lot of our listeners, have heard Turn Back the Clock, which is now, I don't know, I'm guessing 23, 24 years ago that was introduced to the world. And we heard you talk a little bit about some of the ideas and themes that you were able to explore during your solo career, including Tomorrow and your other works as well. So here we are, 2011, going into 2012, and now that you and Mike are back together again as Johnny Hates Jazz, what is it that Johnny Hates Jazz has to say to us now? I realize we may not be able to hear a sample of the new album, right? It's a work in progress. But if you were going to characterize what's upcoming from you, what can we expect from you now?
I'm having to really choose my words carefully here, because I'm representing two people in this interview, Mike as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, both of us see and hear different things mm-hmm. in what we're doing, inevitably, from a writer's perspective, which is my first and foremost my perspective. I think that it's an album which is very much song based. It has great modernity about it, and yet, you know, we are rooted in our experience, and our experience was growing up in the, you know, for my part, the late 60s, 70s. 80s and on. And so, you know, we bring all of that heritage with us. So I think that people will hear some music that we have really efforted to refine as much as possible, and yet hear it in a very contemporary way. In terms of what Johnny Hates Jazz has to say, I think that the way we're looking at it is that this is the first album of several. We don't see this as being a one-off and then we'll go our separate ways and do other things. So that journey is going to evolve over this album, the album afterwards, which I've already started writing, and then probably another one after that and beyond. And I think that you will find anyone who hears that album will hear that there are subjects on that album which, although I've been, how can I put it, I've been careful and somewhat artistic in how I've expressed them, mm-hmm. are very much relevant to some of the challenges that we're facing now, as well as some very personal subjects that are reflections of my life as an individual, and whether they be a reflection of my hopes or my regrets, they're in there as well. So it's hopefully it's the complete circle of my human experience encapsulated in 10 songs. Is that possible? I'm not sure, but we try.
It's a good goal, but yeah.
Don't set the bar too high right out of the gate, Clark.
Very true.
Well, we're very much looking forward to the new album in 2012, and we get a chance to listen to that. And we thank you so much for previewing it for us. And really, it's great to be able to look back at your career and have a discussion about the time in the 80s and what you've been working on these past few years. It's something that we had been talking about here on the show, and we're thrilled that we've been able to finally get you on the show, Clark.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you guys. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Clark, and we're certainly looking forward, given all the enjoyment that your music has brought us over all of the years, to see what is next. And of course, you can be sure updates about the release of the new Johnny Hates Jazz album, as well as tour plans and anything else going on with Clark and Mike and the band, you can expect to hear about it from us here, loyal Johnny Hates Jazz fans on the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. Thank you very much, Clark Datchler.
Thank you, guys.
Well, our big thanks to Clark Datchler from Johnny Hates Jazz. We want to pause here, though, for a moment before we get back to some of the other show content. We'll have one of your Guilty Pleasure songs upcoming here at the end of the show. Actually, maybe we'll play what do you think? Maybe we'll play a Johnny Hates Jazz song fully for the end song. What do you think?
Right. And, you know, not only have we played Shattered Dreams before here on The Grizz, but we've even played some interesting cover versions of it, like one by Christopher Walla from Death Cab for Cutie. So maybe we'll pick out some other Johnny Hates Jazz song to spin at the end.
I have a feeling I know which one I really enjoy, when I would love to hear, but we'll chat about that. But first, I want to thank our good friends at Cobra Electronics. They make two fantastic devices. Let me tell you about them. And if you're thinking about getting a gift for your loved one this year, there's one I think that works great for the dads, perhaps. There's one that works great for the moms or the ladies in the house. The one that works great for the ladies in the house is this Cobra Tag system. We all lose our keys. Sometimes we lose our smartphones. What if there was a device that would fit right on your keychain so you would never lose your keys again? It's the Cobra Tag. It's like a little keychain. And if you can't find your smartphone, you maybe drop your smartphone down the couch cushion somewhere, and you're like, where is that? Well, because you've downloaded the free application that goes with it, you press the little button on the Cobra Tag, beep, beep, you're able to find your phone. And it works in reverse. You can't find your keys. Keys are buried at the bottom of the purse somewhere. Maybe they're in another room in a couch cushion you don't know. Maybe they're in the car. You launch the app on your phone, and it'll find your keys. It's that great. It's that simple. The Cobra Tag. They also, of course, the first device that they ever made was the Cobra iRadar device. And this is fantastic. I mean, Mike is a driver. He's on the road constantly. You use this thing all the time, don't you?
Drive. It's true. And I've used the Cobra iRadar system when I'm road tripping, and here's why. Not only, obviously, if you take a look at it, if you want to go by Cobra.com and look at the iRadar system, you'll see it's a sleek and compact detection unit, and it offers you state-of-the-art radar, red light, and laser detection capabilities. But what makes the thing so great is that the dashboard functionality, there's a free app that you're going to put on your smartphone. It's going to pair right with it via Bluetooth. It allows you to totally customize all the alerts that you're going to get. So if you're really only worried about red light cameras, for whatever reason, you can set it up so those are the only alerts that you hear. If you're only worried about someone tracking your speed, you can get exactly those alerts if that's what you're interested in. What's remarkable about the Cobra iRadar system, among these other things, is that their entire database of driving hazards, which is called the ARA system, gets verified and re-verified twice a day. So you are always getting the most up-to-date current information from the folks over at Cobra, and it's that kind of commitment that's made them the industry leaders. You can see all the awards they've won through 2010 and 2011 when you visit their website, including a great 4-minute demo video that will explain every last detail about the Cobra iRadar system to you. Of course, you can also pick up your Cobra Tag while you're there, or buy them online. They're both available through Amazon.com or in stores like at the Apple Store or at Best Buy if you're out and about doing your shopping in a more bricks and mortar and less clicks and order type way. Anyway, you slice it, Cobra iRadar and Cobra Tag, two great gift ideas for the holidays.
We really thank them for their support of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. Thank you. We should mention we are on Twitter. We are Grizzly Bear Cafe on Twitter. Drop the egg out of the name. It's just too long for Twitter. Grizzly Bear Cafe on Twitter. Of course, our website, grizzlyproductions.tv. You can listen to all of our great shows there and download the brand new weekly long box, which is our brand new comic book episode and show. That is there on our website as we speak. So what else is going on, my friend? Have you been watching anything lately?
Well, other than, you know, here and there, I'm trying to get caught up on Breaking Bad, since I know we're supposed to be discussing that in the very near future.
We watched two episodes back-to-back the other night. It was it's so addictive. We just looked at each other. We said, oh my gosh, we have to watch another one right now. I think we're on going into episode 5 now.
Mm.
And season 2 is just a treat. Oh, so good. So good.
Apart from that, you know, I don't really keep up with anything anymore. I don't have a show in my TV diet like Lost, where I would like rearrange my schedule to make sure that I could be there to watch Lost when it came on.
Yeah, I think I have too many. I feel like, okay, I've got The Walking Dead that I love. Although my wife argues, she's like, I don't know that I would ever care to revisit those characters. She said, but for me, I would. I would love to see what continues with these characters. But in season 2 right now, of course, it just picked up and started again. I love that show. And you know, we're certainly sucked into Breaking Bad. And I've sort of fallen behind on Dexter a little bit. The new season of Dexter has started, and we were on like episode 2, I think, and sort of slipped away from us. So they might be on episode 5 now, and we're sort of behind on that too. So I feel like there are a lot of good shows lately. And there's this new Western show that I wanted to watch. Did you see this new thing? It's been featured all over iTunes. You can, I think, you get the new episode on iTunes. But they were charging for it. Typically, they've been throwing out the first episodes for free. The studios or whatever company wants to release them for free. It's called Hell on Wheels. Have you heard about this show?
I have not.
It's another AMC show. AMC's just hitting home runs lately. It's called, I'll read you the description here.
All right.
AMC's original series, Hell on Wheels, is a powerful story that captures the intensity and inspiration of the American West at a time when nothing less than the future of the nation was at stake. Set in post-Civil War America, Hell on Wheels tells the story of ex-Confederate soldier Cullen Bonahan and his quest for revenge over the wartime death of his wife during the construction of the first transcontinental railroad. Ratings are pretty good so far. I'm just reading through some of the ratings on iTunes. Some people saying Deadwood is better. Most people saying, though, they gave it like 5 stars, 4 out of 5 stars. Hell on Wheels is beautifully directed. Looking forward to learning more about the characters as the season progresses. So, interesting.
Well, you know, one of the AMC series that for a while I was going out of my way to see was called The Killing.
Oh, yeah.
Which was an adaptation of a Dutch television series that was much the same. And since the first season, and the Dutch series, I believe, only had one season, since it came to an end, and it did seem like it was sort of maybe going to be one of those standalone types, right after it ended, AMC came out and said that it would be back for a second season. That was back in the summer. It was like 5 months ago, and there's still been no discussion about them starting to film the second season, when we might see the first episode or anything like that. But I would be very interested to see The Killing return, and it was definitely more so than your average TV fare, I think. It was a very, like, downbeat, kind of depressing. The pacing was very slow and methodical. You never left an episode of Killing, like, feeling upbeat or happy.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, it takes place in Seattle. It's raining nonstop. But it really, the characters are very well done. It's very rare in television these days that you have these original characters that come about. And, you know, when we were watching Breaking Bad, I couldn't help but think, God, this is such an original character. This idea behind this character of Walter White, it's so rare. You get a lot of trite stuff, and he's such a unique character. It reminds me of – I'll never forget when Roger Ebert had said that about movies when Good Will Hunting came out. He described the character of Will Hunting as every decade cinema gets an original character. Will Hunting is this decade's original character. Stands out to me.
Interesting. You know – I was thinking about this as I was making an allusion to somebody being like the wrestling industry's version of
Ebert and Roper, I guess. I'm always tempted to put Siskel in there, but I guess that's not really relevant anymore. And the reason that's fresh on my mind is just over a week or so ago, the wrestling company that I call home, Chikara, had delivered their first iPay-per-view event. It was available worldwide on computers or through Roku Box or on your mobile device, etc. And it marked the conclusion of Season 10, our 10th season, wrapped up at High Noon, even though we do have a couple postseason events coming up here in Philly, Boston, and New York City the first weekend in December, as we're joined by a whole host of the most famous Japanese female wrestlers of all time. It was really interesting to watch, not just socially, you know, as I'm sure you must have talked about us on the trending show. It was huge on Twitter. It was interesting to see all the reviews come in and experiences and everything else that people wrote to us about their High Noon experience, both longtime fans and new fans who just kind of discovered us, that realized that, you know, there is an alternative to mainstream wrestling out there, and that new and interesting things are being done with the performance genre that is professional wrestling, which is in its own way a uniquely American convention. So it's been very interesting to see all of that. As you know, there was kind of like this storm of things going on as we went into High Noon. We released an album of original entrance themes to iTunes. And one of the things that was kind of in this storm of events leading into High Noon was the release of a mobile app that we had been working on for quite a while.
Now, this is exciting. I mean, because I mean, the development that goes into making an iPad app, you know, it takes a long time, and I'm jealous. I have to say, I'm jealous of you guys. I want a Grizzly Productions iPad app, but you guys beat me to it,
so that people can color in Paul Roberts.
Right.
So to be fair, though, you know, a lot of the legwork was done by the fine folks over at Axiva. They're the company that put this thing together for us. This the Color Tunes Chikara app. If you want to check it out, by the way, it's for all iOS devices. You can get it right now in the App Store for a measly 99 cents. And God knows we would love you if you did. Color Tunes Chikara is like an extension of the Color Tunes brand, which is an app which offers like coloring book like functionality. Although you can finger paint over top or whatever you want to do there, and it involves a lot more bells and whistles than just that. Does this new Chikara app? It's got 42 exclusive videos. It's got bio information, photos, all kinds of good stuff. The original theme songs of each of the wrestlers are in there, and it really is our first foray into doing something like that, because Chikara, generally speaking, is at the forefront of these types of new technologies that are out there. And certainly there's no other wrestling company that has something along the lines of this Color Tunes Chikara app. But it calls to mind, and I say this a lot in when I do wrestling-related interviews, which I should point out, I do a lot more interviews in the wrestling sphere than I do in the podcasting sphere. That's because there aren't a lot of messages on the Grizzly Productions voicemail saying, can we get Blip? Can we get him Space Ghost?
We get the monkey on the show? We want to get him on.
Yeah. What did the monkey have for breakfast this morning? So it was actually several years ago, before I even had heard the phrase video podcast, when my guest star on today's Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, Clayton Morris, had put forth the idea to those of us at Chikara, you know, you guys should really get a video podcast. And so Chikara Podcast-A-Go-Go came into the world, I guess this was back in March of 2005, give or take, and really put us at the forefront of the then emerging video podcast form. And it's interesting now, of course, Chikara Podcast-A-Go-Go is here on the Grizzly Productions Network. You can catch it not just, you know, iTunes, YouTube, Blip, everywhere else that it goes, but right here at grizzlyproductions.tv as well. In that, you know, that really fell out of Clayton's brain, was that idea. And some people, I think, were curious why we were so far behind, because a lot of other people have tried this iPay-per-view thing before. You know, I don't know if I would necessarily want to sit down, for example, and watch a wrestling event on my mobile phone.
Right.
Like, I don't know that makes up my experience. My experience when I would do that used to be, you know, Clayton and I would get together at a friend's house, and we'd order some pizza, and we'd bring over cream soda, and we'd, you know, wrestle around in the basement until somebody's parents yelled at us. Like, that was my experience. You know, it was a little more social than that. Whereas to me, like, watching it on a mobile device, like, that's a very personal experience.
Certainly, in Japan, that's actually how most content is consumed. You know, Japan sort of drives the innovation for mobile handset manufacturers, it seems. And, you know, in Japan, folks are on the train. They're just constantly watching videos and different things on their phones. That's how they consume television. That's how they consume movies. That's how they consume music videos. It's on their it's on their personal device. So, you know, what may be odd for us here in the United States or just starting to become more in vogue, you know, on a flight, loading up your iPad with a number of television episodes and different things. But I have to say, you know, like there's been a couple of presidential debates recently that have been, you know, you're able to stream them on your iPad or through whatever provider is, you know, providing the presidential debate. You can just jump on their website, whether it was C-SPAN or whatever, and just be able to stream it right on your iPad or your laptop or whatever you want to do, you know. So, and a lot of the big sporting events have gotten into doing that. Of course, you know, MLB has their incredible MLB.tv application. So I watch Phillies games when I'm on the road and different things on my iPhone or on my iPad. And but during the big sort of like the Masters, you know, the big golf tournament, they'll release like an app, Masters 2011, and it'll be sponsored by Rolex or something like that. But then you get to watch the Masters live on your device, you know, Android and iPhone and whatever. The U.S. Open did that this year, so you're starting to notice that a lot more. But of course, the big ones like NFL and stuff, they still want to kind of clamp down. They want you to, you know, only be able to watch all of their matches or all their games through the DirecTV or something like that.
Right. And of course, there's probably a lot of high stakes licenses and other things, you know, that are all at stake when you're talking about, you know, major league sports, like that kind of stuff. There's, you know, advertising revenue dollars that have to be considered and everything else like that. But it was fascinating to me to hear from people who said, you know, I sat down and I watched it on my iPad, you know, in the window of a Starbucks, you know, or things like that, because it's an emerging technology and it's still imperfect. The iPay-per-view model is still not perfect. There's plenty of rooms for, you know, people would say, oh, like for a while the audio was off track or it dropped some frames or, you know, whatever those types of issues are. It's difficult for me, not being as tech savvy as my pal Clayton, sometimes to relate to what, you know, the experience that we're hearing related to us by our fan base. But it really has turned into something stunning in that we had people from 32 different countries around the world watching us live, along with, you know, the biggest live crowd that we ever had there assembled at the former ECW Arena in Philadelphia, observing us live. Our fan base, for once, was really connected. And I read a blog by a British fan of ours who said, you know, because I'm on the other side of the Atlantic, I will never have the opportunity to experience Chikara live, unless, of course, they come to tour in England. And he said it was the first time that we were really the entire fan base. It wasn't like there were those of us waiting to read the results later on Twitter or find out what happened after the fact. We were all, for those 2 hours and 45 minutes, we were connected.
That's cool.
We were all there experiencing it live as one. And just reading him relate that experience was very, very interesting and made me understand the power of the medium. Because as I said, to me it seemed like something that was very isolated, right? Like you're watching it by yourself on a mobile device. Or that's not to say you couldn't have put it through a Roku box on your TV and filled the room up with people. But, you know, in my mind I had kind of imagined it being a very solitary experience. So it was very interesting to read a counterpoint to that, where what this fan in particular was saying, that he never felt so connected before to everybody else as they kind of experienced it live. And as the thousands of people who got to see it live were all kind of tapped in for those that are very emotional 2 hours and 45 minutes as we made company history at the end of season 10. That was all very interesting. And so, too, it's been interesting to hear the feedback about everything else, whether it's music that we've put out or something that seems to have captured the imagination of a lot of people, called Mysterium Populous, about which legally nothing more can be said, or like this new mobile app, thanks to our friends over at Xeva, that's out there. And if you do have the chance to pick it up, you certainly don't have to be a wrestling fan by any stretch of the imagination to enjoy this. It's fun. It's aimed at kids of all ages. It's colorful and it's interactive, and our friends at Xeva did a great job. We'd love for you to review it in the App Store, because that's going to help more people discover it. And certainly I would love to see the folks over at Xeva that worked so very, very hard on this app rewarded for all of their efforts, because they did a fantastic job for us.
Yeah, cool stuff. So, yeah, check it out in the iTunes store. I know my wife got it, I have it, and my son loves it. He gets to color, and of course he loved the original Color Tunes app as well, so it's fun to be able to draw on you, which is the key.
That's right. You can put a crazy curly Q mustache on me, like as if I'd be the villain in a silent film tying you to a train track.
Hey, did you ever hear about this? We did this on our show last week, but this Go Mo Bro charity event. Have you heard this?
No.
It's a Movember, growing a mustache for Movember, for November. And so they're
this is a charity event, growing a mustache, is it?
Yeah, all these different teams. Like, you could create your own team and then, you know.
Grow a mustache.
And grow a mustache and try to raise charity, so, or raise money, so people go on your team's website and donate $20 or $30 or whatever. And all of the money then goes to men's cancer research, so prostate cancer and other things. Really good cause. And so we've been updating the team, this team on our show on a regular basis this past week. Their team name is Burt Reynolds Hates Cancer.
Hmm.
Which is a great name because, you know, Burt Reynolds has a great mustache.
Indeed he does.
So... But it's funny because I wish I could grow a mustache, but I wouldn't mind growing a beard.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when I'm not on the air, so during the week, I don't shave. I hate shaving. And I can grow, you know, my facial hair, I can grow pretty darn quickly. Yours grows pretty quickly, though, can it?
Yes, like very much so. I couldn't go a full day without shaving. I'm curious, you know, it was always considered a popular tenet that you couldn't trust a broadcast professional with a mustache,
right?
That it somehow was, in viewers inferred that they were untrustworthy,
right?
Is this still widely held to be true?
I have to think that it is. I don't know that. I think there's this perception that you're a little seedy, right? And it's always why in movies, if you're going to add like a character like who's a little shady, give him a goatee or give him a mustache, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see that Adam Sandberg clip from Saturday Night Live where he's the school instructor teaching the class how to use MySpace?
No, I don't think so.
So my wife, because I was like, who is Adam Sandberg, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've never seen like many.
Andy Sandberg.
That's probably why.
Right, yeah.
Andy Sandberg. I'm like, who is he? Like, why? I've never really seen much of him on SNL. Like, why is he suddenly in vogue? I don't get it. I don't know. Is he funny? Is he particularly funny?
I don't think he's like the breakout star, you know, like yeah. of the crew that he's in with. I think that Kristen Wiig outshines him.
Yeah, be sure. But you had mentioned that they've been putting him more forward lately on the show.
Right. But like to me, he's never been like Adam Sandler when he broke out, or he's not even like a great utility player like Phil Hartman, like an unsung hero, or Daryl Hammond. Like he's just kind of like I think he appeals to the younger demographic, like. High school, college-age kids, he's really dialed into what that sense of humor is.
So there was a clip we watched. You can watch it on Hulu because, you know, they have every SNL episode up on Hulu Plus. And they break them down by clips, too. So you can just do a search for Andy Sandberg MySpace teacher or something like that, or MySpace class. Mm-hmm. And so we watched that the other night because my wife gave me a tutorial in Andy Sandberg. She's like, well, here are his famous ones. You got to watch this, right? So there was like the Natalie Portman song where she breaks into a rap song.
Right, yeah, I'm familiar with that one.
That one's apparently pretty famous, pretty viral. And then this one was pretty funny where he's teaching this MySpace class where, you know, it was like at a community center. Like if you wanted to learn how to use social media, you went to this class. And so he says, you know, welcome to MySpace 101. This is a class where we're going to teach you how to get up and running and using MySpace and, you know, finding your friends there. And of course, this is back in the day before Facebook was popular. And they pan the room, and it's all like 40-year-old guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all like pedophiles.
Mm-hmm.
And they've all got mustaches. Not one of them doesn't have a mustache. So you want to paint some – like, and it wouldn't have worked. And I was thinking about it as I was looking at these individuals like Horatio Sands or the other characters in the room who are all like, now let's say that – I wanted to, you know, if my son wanted to use MySpace and he wanted to get online and, you know, find his 19-year-old girlfriend, would he be able to do that using this website? Yes, he would. Okay, good. And then they're going around looking at screen names, and he's like over their shoulder, and he's like, now you probably want to pick a screen name that's representative of you. You know, some people use their birth year. And he looks down at one guy's birth year, and it says, like, Lucky Star 83. or whatever, like on his, you know, on his screen, and he's like, "Well, why would you want to pick 83?" He's like, "Well, that was a good year for me. You know, that was a good year." So he's trying to, you know, shake his name. But they've all got mustaches. So mm-hmm. I was looking at them, and if they didn't have the mustache, they wouldn't have been as creepy.
I see.
They wouldn't have been as creepy.
So somewhere Burt Reynolds right now is he's tearing up what Clayton has to say.
So anyway, but gomobro.com if you want to join up for the last few weeks of it. See, my thing is we're looking at these updates of these guys with these mustaches, and they're weak. I'm like, wait a second. You mean to tell me after 3 weeks that's all you've got? I could outdo you in 2 days.
Yeah. I didn't realize if there was some kind of competition to be had for quickly growing your facial hair, I really needed to be in that time.
Next year, let's
make sure we form a team early next year for this. So,
anyway, what kind of razor do you use? Do you use one of those electric razors?
No, they just piss my face off. Yeah, they turn my face pink for a little bit, and nothing really happens. Makes my face hot, and then I still feel dirty all day. Like those have never worked. I've gotten them for Christmas. I don't know how many years.
And they don't work.
No, they totally don't. I use like a disposable razor, you know, for like a week, and then I do / 3 weeks until it's rusty, 2 months, and then I throw it away.
Kevin Nealon. Mm-hmm. I can't use one of those electric razors. And I don't know if you've seen this commercial, because you know it's the holidays now. You can always see all these commercials for razors, for electric razors for dads. And
it's an easy gift. I at least 3 Christmases I've been given one as a gift.
Yeah. And you know, people writing on Twitter last week, someone said, just listening to the podcast last week when we were talking about Stridex pads, I Am the God of Puck writes this on Twitter, says, just started listening to the Grizz. My face instantly burned from you guys talking about Stridex pads last week on the show.
Right on. I Am the God of Puck, by the way, sent in last week's Guilty Pleasure song selection. We played Real American by Rick Derringer, which was Hulk Hogan's entrance theme in the heyday of the WWF. Rick Derringer also did, you might be interested to know, the Demolition theme, which is a very memorable wrestling theme. And he also did, this was a legitimate radio hit for him, Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo.
Oh, nice.
Was Rick Derringer. But he's like a celebrated, you know, he's kind of like one of those guys, maybe not exactly like Stan Bush, where you don't realize how much stuff Rick Derringer has done until you really take a look. You know, maybe if you looked him up on Wikipedia or something, you would realize that Rick Derringer's like done everything. Sort of the same thing. You know, after he was on our program once or twice, and we kind of got to be friends with Stan Bush, and friends of ours would kind of ask us about him. Like, that's crazy that you had him on the show, you know, the guy that sings The Touch from the Transformers movie and all this other stuff. You don't realize how much stuff that guy's done.
Right.
You know, like, he did pretty much every soundtrack in the 80s. He was on all of them. Like, all these crazy famous commercial jingles, like everything else. Rick Derringer is kind of in that same boat. Like, you don't realize how much stuff, the volume of work, it's just... you know, he's not like out there in the spotlight all the time, is Rick Derringer.
Yeah. Hey, we got an email from Derek in Maine. Derek Toby writes us. He says, hey guys, I've just started listening to your podcast, and I have to say, I love it. I found it when I heard Mike on the Art of Wrestling show. Mm. It was cool to hear your story and how you got into wrestling. I love this podcast. It's kind of like listening to me and my friends talk to each other. I'm really looking forward to the comic book podcast. I just got back into reading the New 52, and I'm reading many of those titles and love most of them. And I have to say, I agree with them. You know, the other day I just picked up there's this whole tie-in with Justice League now with Aquaman. Pretty cool, really cool stuff. And I'm telling you, Justice League is so entertaining. It really is entertaining. So there's this big drop-down fight in the middle of the street between Superman, Batman, the Flash. They call the Flash at the last second to get him out to help, because they can't keep up with Superman, and Green Lantern is there, and Superman's just kicking the crap out of all of them. But they don't really know each other yet. That's right. The thing. You know, and he calls the Flash, and he's like, we need you. I need you right now. And he's like, Batman's here too. And he says, Batman exists? He's real? You can't like fathom that he's real. So the New 52 has been really entertaining. Have you picked any of them up yet on your iPad or otherwise?
No, I did thumb through a few at a comic book store, but I just couldn't bring myself to take the plunge. I don't know why. Like, I feel like since I've gotten to that phase where I no longer actively collect comics, it's really hard for me to go back to that. I'm not really sure why. I did like, you know, every once and again they've done that where they've somehow pushed the reset button on the continuity, and I like when they've done that, where they framed it where the DC Universe at large doesn't know that Batman exists officially. He's sort of thought of as like an urban myth. Right. And then, you know, so he's always avoiding being photographed. Like, he never, you know, he's always certain that no one actually ever really captures any concrete evidence of him existing. So I always like that when they introduce that dynamic where, you know, some of the members of the Justice League are very out there. They're very public, you know, like Wonder Woman's a good spokeswoman, and they put them out you know, when they're all getting medals from the president or whatever happens at the end of the, you know, the story arc. And, you know, Batman's never seen that. He's more like a rumor. Someone heard that there might be a Batman, but he doesn't officially exist. So I do like that dynamic.
Oh, and if you like Batman, boy, I just started playing Batman Arkham City last night.
Mm.
The new one. Oh,
the trailer online looked blow away. Like, oh, I was, my mind was boggled by it.
It kicks you into gear playing as Bruce Wayne. You've been beat up at a press conference. That's how the game unfolds. And you play the first, you know, the first 20 minutes or so of the game as Bruce Wayne with your hands in handcuffs.
Mm.
As inmates basically try to attack you in Arkham City. And the Penguin makes his appearance and, like, beats the crap out of you.
Mm.
Oh, it's so entertaining. It's so well done. There's a new, there's a few new little tips and tricks you can use for the character in the gameplay. And so when you, like, jump off a building and swoop down to do a, like, attack someone, you know, like 100 feet down, mm-hmm. you have, like, more control over his flying, so you can pitch up or down. So you know how, you know, in the scene in Dark Knight when he goes to China, one of the great scenes in the movie when he jumps off the building and swoops around.
Right, you see the whole Hong Kong cityscape.
Oh, I love that scene. And what I love, too, is his Chris Nolan's directing in that scene, because there's no music, right?
Mm-hmm.
He jumps off the building and there's that dun-dun, dun-dun, you know, and then it just pauses. No music. And you just hear the flapping of the cape.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. And then he pitches down, right? He kind of rolls his head down and pulls his cape down, and then it kind of goes into a more of a speed mode where he smashes through the window.
Mm-hmm.
So they've added that to this game now. So you have this, like, sort of pitch mode. You can, like, pull back a little bit. Like where at the end of the, you know, Batman Begins, he flies out of the train where Liam Neeson dies and he flaps backwards, you know.
Right.
You can kind of do that and then kind of dive into more of an attack dive, which is awesome. A couple of added things to it, but you get the sense, like, the, and Catwoman's in there, so you're sort of teaming up with Catwoman a little bit in the game. And there's also this added code that you can play the game as Catwoman. So if you buy the game, which we did, my wife bought it for me, there's a little code that comes inside the box that you can play the game as Catwoman. You can unlock that and play it. So oh boy, I don't play a lot of games these days, but that's one I'm addicted to already.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to playing it. I hope that gets ported out to TurboGrafx-16 really soon. So
your Apple IIc.
Yeah, before we're gonna play a song by Johnny Hates Jazz here to wrap it up. But since Thanksgiving is in the air, we should, or at least I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all the people that make this possible, this little podcasting universe, and everything that I do as well, because I do a lot more than just podcasting. So obviously, I want to take this opportunity to thank my wife. And our beautiful baby boy, Elliot, as well, who is now 2.5 years old, as hard as it is for me to believe that. I'm very grateful also to my friend Clayton Morris, who, as you heard earlier, is the space ghost of Grizzly Productions, and to his wife as well, because every time I've ever had to call on them for things various and sundry, everything you could think of in terms of whether it's input or advice or showing their face on the beloved Throwdown Lowdown, whatever the case might be, they've always been there to support, and I'm very, very thankful for that, if it's not said enough. And I also want to take this opportunity to thank Jim, who's our editor, who has to deal with all the various technical gaffes, as well as my somewhat abrasive personality on a routine basis. This program would not be possible if it weren't for the hard work of Jim. So thanks, Jim, for sticking with us. Unfortunately, your pink slip was just mailed. And I want to thank all of the great show sponsors, because if it were not for them, this network would not function. We simply would not be able to dedicate all the time and everything else that we do to this if it weren't for great show sponsors like Gazelle, Cobra, and the ones on some of our other programs too. PowerMat. Who else am I forgetting? I know there's some others out there on other shows of ours.
Yeah, iHome, iHomeAudio.com.
iHome, yes.
Yeah. And by the way, we should mention iHome is sponsoring our Sports Report show right now. Use the coupon code Clayton20. You'll get 20% off any iHome purchase you make for any of your sound equipment for the holidays. iHomeAudio.com.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to thank, too, some of the great guest stars that we've had this past year since our last Thanksgiving episode, whether it was like Mr. Clark Datchler, who was very gracious, the frontman of Johnny Hates Jazz, who joined us today, or past guests that we've had most recently, like John Flansburgh of They Might Be Giants, and everybody else that has helped make this thing the success that it is. Because it's hard to imagine if you went back 3.5 years ago, as Clayton and I were sitting at a Gloria Jean's cafe discussing what this would become. It's hard to imagine that we'd be here now, looking at what it has turned into, the flagship program here at GrizzlyProductions.tv. And thanks to all of our loyal listeners who help spread the word about the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe and all the content that we create over here. It is thanks to you evangelizing on our behalf that we have grown. And the Chikarma, I wanted to call them the Chikarmi. I'm always like so ready to drop that term.
Yeah.
It's the Egghead Army, which is totally different from the Chikarmi, except for all the people that cross over. The Egghead Army, 2 million strong and growing.
And my thanks to my lovely wife, who puts up with me on a regular basis, but not only
almost every day she does.
Yeah, really. I mean, sometimes she boots me outside. Mm-hmm. But of course, to my best friend Mike and his lovely family as well for indulging me in my obsessions with this network and everything Grizzly. I think it's safe to say you and I have created something pretty special here over the last 4 years, and I'm really looking forward to 2012. I think we're gonna do some really great things with some of the stuff we have in the pipeline, the expansions that we're looking at doing. So to all of the folks who have found and been a part of this project over the last few years, we really thank you. And thanks to every one of you who listens to this show and in our entire network, all the feedback. You're always gracious. You guys never say any mean things, you know? If anything, it's always constructive criticism.
Well, I do delete those.
Right. Oh, good. So I don't get to see them. Because you know I'm delicate. That's why.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I take kindly to criticism, so thanks mm-hmm. for deleting those. But yeah, thanks all around to everyone for listening to this show and bringing us into your homes. Wherever, if you're out taking a walk with your dog, you listen to this show, you're in home working out. I always love to think about how all these folks listen to our shows and what way we get to connect to their lives in a certain way. And it's really special. They take an hour and a half out of their day to listen to a show that means the world to us.
Mm-hmm. So to wrap up today's show, we've been playing some Guilty Pleasure songs, and perhaps one from Johnny Hates Jazz will fit the mold. Now, you said you had one in mind that you wanted to play.
Yeah, I did. I'm kind of torn, but what was your suggestion?
I really like Heart of Gold, which I know did not get quite the radio play that I Don't Want to Be a Hero did, but I prefer that to that, and I prefer it to Turn Back the Clock as well.
All right. Well, let's do that. Let's do Heart of Gold, because I think Turn Back the Clock is not as much of a guilty pleasure. I think it certainly did pretty well in the charts. So, well, Heart of Gold did pretty well too, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sleeping on Don't Say It's Love, which is another fine Johnny Hates Jazz song. I'd position this as the number two hit in my mind on the album is Heart of Gold.
All right, so let's listen to Heart of Gold here, a guilty pleasure from the folks at Johnny Hates Jazz. And we'll update you in the new year when their new album comes out. And our big thanks to Clark Datchler for joining us on this Where Are They Now episode of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe.